Well, again, it's been a month since Dialogue Conspiracy, and it's hard to know where to begin. A whole month of conspiracies, new conspiracies being packed in and added to the old one. And I guess we begin right with today, the Mansfield probe, the request for the probe of the Watergate. I spent a lot of time since June on KLRB, an hour a week, talking about the arrest at the Watergate Hotel, because I felt that my 9 years' research into political assassinations was a good background to understand what was happening at the Watergate Hotel. And it still is a good background to understand what was taking place there. And only now are members of the Congress and James Reston of the New York Times and public officials becoming very serious about the most important event that took place in American history. And I'm going to share with you a few articles that were in the paper this week that you may or may not have seen. But before I do that, I want to read you a letter I got from Andrius Papandreou, the former premier of Greece, who was running for election in April 1967. The military coup took over in Greece in 1967. The elections were supposed to be in June. And Papandreou was running. This was the first time that Greece was going to have a chance for a government that represented land reforms, changes in the economy. It wasn't a communist government, extreme left wing. The Nazis had been there, the communists had been there, and Greece had been thrown back and forth since World War II with various types of governments. And Papandreou had been educated in the United States and Europe and came there to make land reforms. And before his election could take place, he was awakened in the middle of the night, and a sword was put into his shoulders. He was threatened, taken out of bed, and taken to prison. And he left Greece and went eventually to Canada, where he's teaching there now as a professor. And any of the people who have listened to my shows before or have heard me at the colleges or high schools know that I always carry a book with me called The Death of a Democracy, and by Stephen Rousseau. This is the story of the overthrow of Greece. And because the men in America that were instrumental in helping to overthrow Greece, like Tom Pappas of the CIA Foundation and Roy Ash from Litton Industries, are in very high positions in Washington and selected Agnew as our vice president, I felt it was imperative to study the Greek coup d'etat, which America actually did as a test case for how this government would be overthrown in the event that a liberal Democrat would ever have a chance of winning the election. Well, Andrius Papandreou got a hold of the article I did in The Realist and wrote to me this December, and this is what he said. He said, "I'm overwhelmed by the amount of work you've done and the documentation you bring to support your thesis. I've tried myself for a long time to bring out the conspiratorial aspect of the Greek coup of 1967, which was actually the American coup, and just now, 5 years later, does it seem that people are beginning to understand how it happened that Greece went under a dictatorship? Your work is tremendously important. You've understood the framework in which these events take place, but more than that, you have dug up the facts." And then he continued some more, ordering some more copies of The Realist and the subscription. "Yours in the struggle, Andrius Papandreou." So I was very pleased to receive this letter, and the broadcast that we have in Carmel, it's a small town, and they go on to Santa Cruz, and the article spreads, and more articles will be coming out that I'm working on now. And eventually the truth will spread around the world about the American coup that overthrew Greece and the American coup that was about to take place in Washington, D.C. at the time the men at the Watergate were arrested. Mike Mansfield, Democrat from Senator, has asked for a full investigation of the Watergate affair in Congress. What is going on now is a ridiculous trial. You can't even call it a trial. And the best thing I can say about watching the day-to-day development of the Justice Department prosecuting the two defendants are left is that if you read the reports of this trial, getting the Washington Post and the New York Times, because there's nothing in our local paper, then you can understand how the Justice Department investigated the killing of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, or the shooting of George Wallace, because the important witnesses are not called. These men at the Watergate, the seven that were arrested, were hired by somebody. Everybody knows their name. They were paid by somebody. Everybody knows their name. Men in the White House, like Mr. Timmons, who received their bugging information from the Howard Johnson Hotel, became the chief liaison just over Christmas vacation between Richard Nixon and the Congress. He got promoted. Instead of being arrested, he was promoted. John Mitchell, who had, now it turns out, $900,000 of secret espionage money, hasn't even been named in the suit. The Justice Department doesn't want him for anything, even though he hired these men. He was the head of the committee that employed these men. The important witnesses, even Donald Segretti, who was supposed, who talked the grand jury and gave evidence and was supposed to be involved in hiring hippies and radicals to make it look as if the McGovern people were radicals, and he was meeting with Howard Hunt in Miami, was not called for this trial. So if you watch this trial, just take whatever information comes from it, and we're going into a little of that in a few minutes, but what doesn't come from it tells you how the government protects itself from investigating its own agents. A perfect example that came out in the trial this week was information in the New York Times that Frank Martinez, one of the men arrested at the Watergate Hotel, had evidence in his car the night of the arrest that he was an agent of the Central Intelligence Agency at the time he was arrested in June. They fired him the next day. And yet, the Justice Department, the FBI, made a deal not to bring this evidence out. The FBI is not a political branch of Richard Nixon. It should not be. It is. But the point is that Martinez was an agent of the CIA at the time that he was arrested. And so were all the other men. Their defense fund, their promise of $1,000 a month, every month they're in jail, their funding for the entire operation can be traced to the Central Intelligence Agency. So when 50% of the electorate in this country are sabotaged, the Democrats or the Wallace people, the Peace and Freedom Party, if spies are sent in to sabotage the electoral process, our taxes are paying for it. We're putting money into the Internal Revenue. Come this April, the taxes are due unless you pay them quarterly. And your money goes to espionage your political party if you're not a Republican. And if you are a Republican, they're doing illegal acts that are criminal under the guise of helping the Republican Party, and you are supporting these men in jail for committing crimes. There's no evidence yet that the CIA is not paying their way, their lawyers, and the entire operation. So the average taxpayer, the taxpayer in the United States, is paying these criminals their support, their payoffs, and their legal representation for sabotaging against us. We're paying them to do things against all the political system out of our taxes. And this investigation that's taking place now in Washington is ridiculous. The Justice Department can't prosecute them. But Congress is going to have a full investigation, and I'm going to give a list at the end of the program of letters to write. It's been a month since I've been on the air, and I maybe send 30 or 40 letters a week in addition to all my research and newspapers I get and information across file. And it's time that people outside who are listening get involved in at least 1 to 3 to 5 letters a week to public officials to make your position, your feelings known. Now, Senator Mansfield has asked for a full, open, televised congressional investigation of Watergate. We had it with the McCarthy hearings. We've had it other instances. Write to Sam Ervin, Democrat, North Carolina, or Mike Mansfield. Mansfield said the Watergate was not politics as usual. It was not politics American style. The Watergate incident, I'm quoting, contains implications of great gravity for all political activity in this country. What is involved is not only a question of federal crimes, which are properly subject to judicial disposition, but a cynical and dangerous intrusion into the integrity of the electoral process. Now, when you write to Sam Ervin or Mike Mansfield, say, I support open, full congressional hearings on the Watergate, and you have to prove to us that it was not politics as usual. In other words, open the archives, open the Wallace shooting, open the past political assassinations, and the burden of proof is on you that this same team wasn't involved in all of them. Don't stop with what they did in 1972, because that's only the beginning. As it unrolls, you'll end right back in Dallas. And then we'll begin to solve some of the problems in this country. James Reston had an article this week in the New York Times. It was also in the Monterey Herald, talking about the Watergate men. And that our political offices, whether you're a mayor or a governor or a president, should have to be guarded as if we were engaged in combat with a foreign enemy. And he says, we're seeing the development of political warfare that can destroy the democratic election process. Now, James Reston has been on the side of defending the Warren Report. Even in the article this week, he said Wallace was shot by somebody posing as one of his supporters. Well, if he was posing as a supporter and he wasn't, who paid Brammer? We're getting back to who paid Brammer. Then James Reston mentions the killing of the two Kennedys by people who thought they were serving a higher political purpose by assassination. Well, if men thought they were serving a higher political purpose by killing Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy, and if men thought they were serving a higher political purpose by going into the Watergate Hotel and doing what they were doing, were they the same men? I say they were, and it's up to you to ask Congress, write to Mansfield, write to Irvin, and say the federal government now has to open the archives and open the hearings and have a hearing of James Ray and Arthur Brammer and Sirhan Sirhan and prove to us that this hasn't been the pattern of elections since 1960. After Kennedy was elected, have we systematically taken care of each one of these people? They're getting close to it yet, but they haven't admitted. Now the news media is admitting and the congressmen are admitting the seriousness of the Watergate team. But when it first started out, they couldn't realize the connections. And if you give them a little push or you demand to know, maybe we can get some reaction. I'm going to read you the defense of James McCord this week at the trial for bugging the Democratic headquarters, sabotaging the Democratic Party, and doing many of the things they did. And this is the quotation. If one is under a reasonable apprehension, regardless of whether or not that apprehension is in fact correct, he is justified in breaking a law to avoid greater harm, which in this case would include violence against the Republicans and including the president. Now that's James McCord justifying that he can break one law to prevent another law, even if the truth was that it wasn't going to take place, that violence. Now, we had a full hour last when we used to be on Saturdays, and we're going to take a break at 5:30 for two commercials. And it takes a little time off from Dialogue Conspiracy. But when we get back on, we're going to talk about this plea of James McCord. And I'm going to show you, and you can write to public officials about it, that his justification is a cover-up for the original allegations that I made in June of what that espionage squad was doing, that he is justifying an action that actually would have led to violence instead of the protection of the president. This is an important moment in American history, and I want to keep stressing it because if you see this importance, you will get busy and write your letters and reach your public officials.
And now, here's May.
Okay, now we'll get back to James McCord and that plea that he made that if one is under a reasonable apprehension, regardless of whether that apprehension is in fact correct, he's justified in breaking a law to avoid greater harm. He also said if you have a reasonable apprehension that harm may come to others as well as to yourself, you can break the law to avoid greater harm. Just imagine if you turn that around and say a guard in San Quentin threatens to kill a particular prisoner and they say all the time, I can't wait to kill you. And then that would justify the prisoner killing him to prevent other murders. But try to use that for your defense if you're not James McCord. McCord's been with the CIA for 21 years, and his justification for the sabotaging of the Democratic Party was to prevent greater harm. Now let's go into the evidence that we had at the beginning of June on what was going to come down at the convention, at the Miami convention, not the Democrat, but the Republican convention in San Diego that was switched to Miami. Louis Tackwood made the allegations. I'll repeat them briefly now. He's the agent provocateur for the LAPD, who quit the LAPD in the fall of 71 because he was hired to hire radicals to create violence at the Republican conventions. The radicals would be killed and the Democrats would be blamed. And this would be an excuse for martial law. He said there is an espionage squad, a team set up. It was formed in 1971. They were going to kill the news media and congressmen. They would hire hippies and radicals. They would kill those who were hired to conceal the origin of their plans. They would round up the radicals, the anti-war protesters, and create martial law for a police state. And then they would kill Nixon. Now let's take the evidence that's come in, just a little bit of it, in the Watergate trial as it opened. And since James McCord made the speech, I want a resume of whether he was in fact protecting Richard Nixon by bugging the Democratic offices and wiretaping and doing the things that he was doing. In the first place, when McCord was arrested at that hotel, he was hired with four men who had made reservations or provisions for violent demonstrations in Miami at the time of the GOP conventions. Martinez, Sturgis, Gonzalez, they had room reservations. They were planning demonstrations to favor the bombing of Haiphong, things that would be unpopular with the youth group. And they were bringing in far right-wing extremists into the area. And therefore, they were encouraging violence. They were not protecting Richard Nixon by demonstrating in favor of his most unfavorable policies. Donald Segretti said, like I said before, he was sent to Miami. Another gentleman spoke up this week and met in Miami with Howard Hunt, one of the men arrested. They were to hire hippies, long hairs, radicals, and get them to do demonstrations and actual violence in Miami. If McCord was protecting Nixon as chief of security in Miami, why were the men he was arrested with hiring people to create violence? In May, the same people that he was arrested with, Bernard Barker, and the same men that were with him at the Watergate Hotel who got away and were not arrested, were flown from CIA money, our taxpayers' money, from Miami to Washington, D.C., and were involved in violent demonstrations. They didn't keep peace. They're not police people. They are provocateurs who are stirring violence in order to make people frightened of the anybody who is opposed to Richard Nixon's policies is made to look like an enemy of the state. Howard Hunt, 21 years with the CIA, had an office in the White House basement with John Ehrlichman, one of Nixon's top men, and he had his own telephone, and he would call to Miami, and Bernard Barker used that phone, and the bills were sent to the home of a secretary who lived in Maryland. Never before had a phone been attached like this to the White House. It's the first time in the history of the White House. Barker was making arrangements for provocations, and these calls were coming directly to the White House. G. Gordon Liddy, who worked with the Treasury Department, a former FBI man, worked with Howard Hunt and Robert Mardian in the White House, in the basement of the White House. They had a particular operation that in the fall of 71, they got together at the same time that Tackwood said the espionage squad got together. Robert Mardian was Assistant Attorney General, in charge of the list of radicals and could provide them with a list of particular radicals or people objecting to Richard Nixon's escalation of the war. He could provide them with all those names, and those would be the people that could be imprisoned first. Mardian left the White House. This team worked in the White House. Howard Hunt, G. Gordon Liddy, and Robert Mardian. They split up, and Hunt went to a CIA office across the street called Mullen Associates, which is a public relations office. And Tackwood said that the cover for this operation was called the Public Relations Office in the LAPD and also in Washington. Hunt went to the Public Relations Office. Liddy went to the Finance Committee that handled the espionage money for these secret operations. And Mardian went to Texas and was a fundraiser where all the secret money was placed for this operation that financed the espionage money. Now, if James McCord's defense was that Richard Nixon's life was in danger, or that the McGovern people were going to plan demonstrations, all the protection that Richard Nixon needs, he can get from the Secret Service and the FBI. There's no reason for a man who's been with the CIA planning operations, that plans coup d'etats or revolutions in Nicaragua, or tries to overthrow Cuba at the time of the Bay of Pigs, or these operatives, there's no reason for them to have money raised by Robert Mardian, who worked with them in the White House, and have that money sent from Texas to Mexico to a corporation that didn't exist, to a particular banker who signed the checks and said he didn't know his name was on it, who then they were put into four cashier's checks and sent back to a oil company in Houston, the chief fundraiser in that area for Nixon, along with Robert Mardian. And then the money was put in another bag with $500,000 and sent to Washington to John Mitchell and the safe of Marie Stans, where it was not listed who gave it or where it came from, and that was against the law. They're being charged with these violations. And then that money was sent down to Florida to Bernard Barker's bank, and some of the money was with the men when they arrested the Watergate. If James McCord is hired by the Secret Service, by Alfred Wong, to protect Richard Nixon in Miami, they should write a plain check. James McCord, here's $1,000 a month. Keep the president alive. But if you are going to kill the president and blame it on the radicals, you have to hide what you're doing. If you're going to kill John Kennedy and blame it on Oswald, you've got 1,000 people working in different departments of operation. If you're going to kill Robert Kennedy and blame it on Sirhan, you've got to have a lot of people covering the investigation, the evidence, and the placement of people to keep these conspiracies going. This was one of the biggest moments in American history, and we must follow it through. None of the money for protecting Richard Nixon had to come from this particular operation. All the money that is needed for his security or for those radicals to take care of those people, all the weapons and all the clubs and mace and everything they needed in San Diego and when it turned to Miami, is available to protect the President of the United States. So the story that he broke a law to prevent crime or harm is an outright lie and fabrication. When all of the men were arrested at the Watergate, James McCord, Howard Hunt, G. Gordon Liddy, Martinez, and Barker, they fled out to California, and they met with John Mitchell and Patrick Gray III, the new acting head of the FBI, and we'll go into that if we have time a little bit. They came out to California, had a big meeting. That's where Martha Mitchell found herself with five men, and they said she only had one, and that's where she was thrown through a plate glass window, and Herbert Kalmbach, Richard Nixon's attorney, took her to the hospital. And she said, politics is nothing but a cops and robbers game. If the whole thing was to protect Richard Nixon, what was Martha Mitchell being thrown out about the window for? Everybody who's involved in Secret Service and hired to protect Nixon from the committee or from the White House has every bit of money they need to protect Richard Nixon. What dirty things could Martha Mitchell see? And Martha Mitchell says, why weren't they arrested? Now, certainly Martha Mitchell didn't mean that men should be arrested who were protecting Richard Nixon, because she liked the job her husband had as Attorney General. She cried when he turned it down. So what was she seeing? And isn't it interesting in this trial that she says, I saw dirty things, why weren't they arrested? And that the prosecution, the Justice Department, hasn't even called Martha Mitchell as a witness or John Mitchell as a witness. And so let's go into Arthur Bremer. When we talk about breaking the law, can we trace that money that Arthur Bremer had? He stayed at the Waldorf Astoria, had airplane tickets, he stayed at fancy hotels in Maryland. Did any of the money that John Mitchell had of the $900,000 espionage funds take care of the Southern Strategy? How do we know it didn't unless we get a full investigation now? Because Nixon has gone on with his war. He said, I have a mandate. I have a mandate. You all gave me this election. And part of it was 20 million Wallace votes that went to him when Wallace was eliminated. So unless we find out who shot Wallace, Nixon doesn't have the mandate he thinks he has. So as the television begins controlled, the news begins controlled, go in to these items. But to get back to this evidence, if James McCord is defending Richard Nixon against possible violence and he has broken the law by listening to telephone conversations in the Democratic Party to protect Richard Nixon against the radicals, he can do and get all that information through the Justice Department. It's only if they wanted to plant the radicals and make them look guilty for what happened that they would be in that office. And there was a man working in that office whose name has come up at the trial, who turns out to be the Judas in the case, who left the scotch tape at the door, who talked on the telephone to the White House and to the people doing the listening, who was relaying the messages. He was the person in there that was working with the Republican Party that could be dangerous to the McGovern people or whoever had the candidacy for the presidency running against Nixon this year. Now, if the truth is told that McCord was protecting the president, then we have to know more about Andrew Topping. You see, Andrew Topping is a man from New York City. He's involved in Wall Street and stocks and bonds, and he was arrested because he was going to kill Nixon between the time of the nomination and the inauguration. And he had passed money to the Secret Service, and he was an extreme right-wing advocate who had access to the White House and was being cleared. And his assassination of Nixon was stopped, and everything was hushed up. And I think it's imperative that the money that he had or passed, if it's marked, be noted, and people know if it was related to the Watergate team. Now, there was a Mr. Lemmer, a Vietnam veteran, who there was a large article about him in last month's Harper's Magazine. And I think you should go out to the library, if you can't still buy it in the stands, I know you can't, and Xerox this particular article, because it fits in with the Lewis Tackwood allegations perfectly. Lewis Tackwood evidently didn't know Lemmer at all. He was speaking a year earlier when he said there was this espionage squad, fall of 71, hire hippies and radicals, create violence, bring down martial law, and kill the people you hire. Lemmer was a Vietnam veteran who came home, who was hired by the FBI and given money and a big expensive account and payments for his car and his wife's expenses to plan violence and plant weapons and encourage violence at the Republican convention in Miami. And he was working with the FBI, and he was approached in the fall of 71 again as part of like the same operation. But he began to get very apprehensive and feel that in the process of what he was doing, he would then be killed. And he got very paranoid about it and went to the Civil Liberties Union and groups and confessed what he was doing. Well, Tackwood realized that he would be killed. Now, Mr. Essex down in New Orleans, who was part of a large massacre we'll be covering in a few weeks, because I think the war is coming home, and this sounds like a special forces operation to spread terror in this country like we did in North Vietnam. Mr. Essex in New Orleans, who was not crazy, who had an interesting background and could be part of those special forces, was murdered and gunned down. There was no chance of his living to tell what happened. Well, Tackwood knew that he and the people he employed would be killed. Lemmer knew that he would be killed and silenced. But he did say that he worked for the FBI and he worked for the CIA. He joined the National Organization in Washington, New York in the spring of 1972. And he met a girl. He had a girlfriend. And he told her, he gave someone a lift down to Miami, and she was coming to conventions. And he said, don't come to those conventions. This was about 2 weeks before the arrest of the Watergate. He said, the city is going to be a warfare state. There's going to be mass violence planned. So don't come to Miami at that time. Now, Lemmer may never have heard of Lewis Tackwood, but he confirms the Tackwood allegations. So the defense of James McCord that's taking place right now is something which has to be questioned by Congress. And what I'm hoping is that you people who listen to my show will write to Congress and say, when you investigate the Watergate affair, you have to go into the Tackwood allegations that Lewis Tackwood asked you, Congress, in 1971 to investigate the espionage squad. And because everything that he said happened, that the way that he said it would fall down, that there was, in fact, an espionage squad, that it did relate
to the state of California, as exemplified in Herbert Kalbach, Nixon's attorney, being part of it, Donald Segretti, and many, many more people in California. And it was a national organization, and they did set up teams in 71, because all of these men that have been interviewed in the news or at the trials or their background, they all formed in 71. Because Tackwood said these things and because Lemmer says them and they're identical, and because when the men were arrested, it all fit together, you have to begin to write some letters. Over Christmas, I got a poem, a beautiful poem from somebody, a student up at Santa Cruz, the university. And I'm just going to take time out before I talk about Patrick Gray just to share a few lines with you, because I'd like to think of this program to be utilized as a course. It's a learning process. It isn't anything I've explained many times, that I'm telling you my opinions based on my research. And I want to give you the sources of information many times of where I get my information so you can get. Well, since you're so small, lean over a little further so they can really kick you. George Jackson wouldn't let them, and he came from the bowels of solitary, and he wouldn't let them. George Jackson, you blow my mind. You make me rise up off the cold cot and go to work. You've thought it all, and what's more, it has to be said. Be prepared for the worst and hope for the best. This is the Christmas message, he said. Do myself a good deed and read. Do myself a good deed and write. Do myself a good deed and not walk around feeling bad for someone wrong to feel good. Give my brothers and sisters support and give my children a political education for their Christmas gift. Keep the rope taut for others to walk and work together, not apart. Value time not to be wasted on triteness in whatever form it may come, and don't go along. Fight like a trooper in this just fight for liberation and survival. Free all the political prisoners and take chains off the bodies of the people and take the chains off the minds of the people. And then he says, and most of all, love, he says, love the guerrilla leaders on the front. And I say, love all those leaders on the front that we talk about on this program that are not yet identified. They're hardly guerrillas, but they were killed because they represent a change in a system that was long overdue, and that's why they were killed. He mentions Ho and Che and Malcolm and Lumumba. And then he goes on to say, and many dedicated men with marked and unmarked graves. So as I rattle on in Dialogue Conspiracy, I hope this next year, because we're starting a new year now, that you be prepared for the worst and you hope for the best and you read. Do yourself a favor and read some of this information. Study the trials that come through and then write. Do yourself a good deed and write, and don't complain when the war escalates or pulls down or new oppressions come around. And value your time. Don't waste it and get to work. Now, Patrick Gray, we're going right to Patrick Gray because he is not yet appointed the head of the FBI. And there's good reason to believe now that if you give that final push, it just may be that he will not be appointed, because if he's appointed, you can say it's about the grayest day for American investigation or justice that could ever happen, because every time a new person's taking over, they're getting worse. There's no ray of sunshine, and the only hope is to halt their appointment, because once they're in, it's just hard to get them out. And John McClellan from Arkansas, the senator, is interested in justice. Write to him. Patrick Gray should no more be head of the FBI than I just can't imagine the right of this man to be the head of the FBI based upon his experience since May. The reasons he's being criticized by a lot of the FBI people, too. They're turning against him, a lot of them. So if you support them and have your own ideas and write to John McClellan and write to Senators Cranston and Tunney, write a whole bunch of senators, because it's terribly important who investigates the crime. We're talking about Dialogue Conspiracy and assassinations, but if the planners of the assassination investigate themselves, we'll never, ever get these things untold, and we have to find out what's happening. Now, Patrick Gray is much too political to be in the FBI in the first place. He gave up a career in the Navy to work for Nixon since 1960, and that was the year when Kennedy won, and the determination was made to eliminate Kennedy. This Mr. Romero that I talked about November from Algiers spoke up. He has a book coming out in Paris, and he spoke about the Americans, two men from the Secret Service that approached him to kill John Kennedy and offered several $100,000 if he'd have him killed in France. Well, after the Watergate arrest, CBS took pictures of the Watergate men to Romero, and he has identified those men, which means that since 1961, the plans were made to kill John Kennedy, and I say from the time that he won the election. So people that have worked for Richard Nixon since 1960 are too close to Nixon and this whole era to, after leaving the West Point to work for Nixon, he's too close to that campaign. He called off the investigations that would hurt Richard Nixon if the truth were told, such as the Wallace shooting, the Watergate investigation, the ITT. He's the one who worked with Kleinitz and halted that. And in Los Angeles, he called off the Salazar and Isla Vista investigations, among other things. He was out in California at the same hotel as John Mitchell after the Watergate arrest. Now, I don't know that they were in the same room, but I know that Martha Mitchell didn't see her husband for 24 hours when she was being brutalized and thrown around. So John was somewhere not with his wife, but at the same hotel as Patrick Gray. And out there was Fred LaRue from the White House and Charles Colson. And in California, and then was Howard Hunt, who escaped the FBI. They said there were 150 agents looking for him, and he's in California, the same state and maybe the same city and maybe the same room as Patrick Gray. And all the defendants, and Robert Mardian, all of them out in California. Then Mardian, the former assistant attorney general, went with Fred LaRue back to the offices. That Monday, they were in California on the weekend, they went back and destroyed all the records of the secret stash fund in Marie Stan's safe. And then the FBI comes in to the committee to reelect Richard Nixon and says, we can't find anything. The chief of the FBI is out in California with all the guilty people. They go back to Washington, destroy the records, and then he sends his agents. Why didn't he send his agents while the men were out in California before the records were destroyed? Why weren't the agents of the FBI right there the night the men were arrested? Patrick Gray has told certain agents who were inquisitive of the Watergate Hotel, they were fired. FBI man has been fired because of getting too inquisitive. He told other people, the FBI man told other people in Miami, and the hotel chief in Watergate who made room reservations, his name was among the men in the notebook of the men arrested. They were told not to talk. He hushed up that investigation. The money, the mobility of Arthur Brammer has not been told, and that murder, that assassination attempt of Wallace took place just a few days after Patrick Gray came into the FBI. Wes Graff was fired by Patrick Gray in Los Angeles. Wes Graff was the head of the FBI at the time of the Robert Kennedy killing. He was fired at the time. He had $500,000, and one half of that was guaranteed by C. Arnold Smith, Richard Nixon's long associate and one of the first supporters in the Committee of 100. And when Patrick Gray asked Wes Graff to resign, he said, we won't go into his financial holdings. He's been accused by the FBI of moving too far and too fast, and this is important because that's the way Greece was overthrown. The old generals were never moved up. The new colonels kicked them out when the coup took place, the same way that Mr. Haig was moved up over many, many names in the Pentagon to work right under Kissinger now. The excuse is, we want youth, but what they're doing is putting in their trained men and getting out the old-timers. The FBI has created the image now that we have young lawyers, mustaches, colored shirts, females. We're hiring blacks, and we've abolished our crime records of non-criminals, such as musicians, artists, civil rights leaders. That looks like such a big deal, but he opened up his liaison with the CIA, which they hadn't had for a few years, so he can get all that information from the CIA files. The FBI doesn't need files on us, because now, with Patrick Gray there, the FBI is the CIA. So they can do anything they want. They can hire long-haired black women. You know, I don't care. That doesn't make them liberal. There's every bit of evidence that Patrick Gray is covering up all the information that would be important to impeach Richard Nixon. Impeach could be done. He's encouraged 40 of the old-timers, encouraged in quotes, to get out and just 6 months, and he's outright fired some and shifted it around. And at the time of the conventions, at the nomination before the elections, he was using the FBI to gather political intelligence to turn over to the Nixon campaign operatives. And when they asked him about this, couldn't it be used for blackmail or to intimidate candidates, he said, wouldn't you do that for the president? Now, Patrick Gray is representing his president. He's supposed to represent our Justice Department. Well, time is running out on Dialogue Conspiracy. There's always so much to do each week, and we have to sign off, but you could spend some time writing letters like I've been doing, and don't think the letters don't count. They do count. You can write to Mike Mansfield, Democrat of Montana, Sam Ervin, tell me you want public televised hearings of the Watergate, complete with Attaquan allegations, and the LAPD can't supply the information on the Attaquan allegations. You have to have an objective person go into the Los Angeles Police Department. Not, they can't say we looked into it and it wasn't true. We need Congress to go into those and write to your congressman that you do not want Patrick Gray as the head of the FBI. He is too involved with Richard Nixon, and he has exhibited his ability to cover up the two major investigations that have allowed Richard Nixon to become president, the Watergate Hotel and the Wallace shooting. And write to Sacramento about the violence at San Quentin that's coming down on the prisoners. We'll do more on the show next week. But get involved and spend some time this week. Everyone has time. And we'll talk more about the conspiracies next week.